better, because without butter from cows that live at altitude and graze on high pastures, your wort will taste of Kroger, or Food Mart, or Land O'Lakes. For mezcal celebrations, if you want a sheep slaughtered in Brooklyn, call Johannes, and in Boston, try the Queen of Sheba's. In my years away from my birthland, living in America, I will see how Ethiopians are invisible to others, yet so visible to me. Through them, I will easily find other recordings of Tizeta. They are eager to share, to thrust that song in my hands, as if only Tizeta explains the strange inertia that overcomes them. It explains how they are brilliant at home, the Jackson Five, the Temptations, and Tizeta on their lips, a perfect afro on their heads, bell-bottoms swishing above 007 boots, and then the first foothold in America, behind the counter of a 7-Eleven, or breathing carbon monoxide fumes in a Kinney underground parking lot, or behind the counter of an airport newsstand or Marriott gift shop, has turned out to be a cement foot plant, a haven that they are fearful of leaving lest they suffer a fate worse than invisibility, namely extinction. Getachew Kasa's slow version of Tizeta, a bright but haunting sober lament on a backdrop of minor chord arpeggios, is the best known. He has another version, with a fast Latin rhythm. Mahmoud Ahmed, Astor Aweke, Teddy Afro, every Ethiopian artist records a Tizeta. They record it in Addis Ababa, but also in exile in Khartoum. Yes, Khartoum, which proves that even hell has a recording studio. And of course in Rome, Washington D.C., Atlanta, Dallas, Boston, and New York. Tizeta is the heart's anthem, the lament of the diaspora, reverberating up and down 18th Street in the Adams Morgan section of Washington D.C., where it pours out from Fasikas, Addis Ababa, Maskerem, Red Sea, and other Ethiopian eateries, drowning out the salsa or the ragas emanating from El Rincon and Queen of India. There is a fast Tizeta, a slow Tizeta, an instrumental Tizeta, which the Ashantis made so popular, a short and a long Tizeta. There are as many versions as there are recording artists. That first line, I hear it now. Tizetash zoweter, wede eni eyameta. I can't help thinking about you. Chapter 18. Sins of the Father. In our household, you had to dive into the din and push to the front if you wanted to be heard. The foghorn voice was Ghosh's, echoing and tailing off into laughter. Hema was the songbird, but when provoked, her voice was as sharp as Saladin's scimitar, which, according to my Richard the Lionhearted and the Crusades, could divide a silk scarf allowed to float down onto the blade's edge. Almaz, our cook, may have been silent on the outside, but her lips moved constantly, whether in prayer or song no one knew. Rosina took silence as a personal offense, and spoke into empty rooms and chattered into cupboards. Gennet, almost 6 years of age, was showing signs of taking after her mother, telling herself stories about herself in a sing-song voice, creating her own mythology. Had Shiva Marion been delivered vaginally, impossible given how our heads were connected, Shiva, presenting skull first, would have been the firstborn, the older twin. But when the cesarean section reversed the natural birth order, I became the first to breathe, senior by a few seconds. I also became the spokesperson for Shiva Marion. Trailing after Hema and Ghosh in the piazza, or threading between Gary's and Lori's and Motilal's garments in the crowded mercato of Addis Ababa, I never heard Hema say, "That blue shirt will look so good on Shiva," or, "Those sandals are perfect for Marion." The arrival of Dr. Ghosh and Dr. Hema meant chairs were dragged out and dusted, and a boy sent running to return with warm Fanta or Coca-Cola and biscuits, despite all protests. Tape measures sized us, our cheeks were pinched by rough hands, and a small crowd gathered to gawk, as if Shiva Marion was a lion in the cages at Siddhist Kilo. The upshot of all this would be that Hema and Ghosh purchased 2 of whatever piece of clothing it was they felt we needed. Ditto for cricket bats, fountain pens, and bicycles. When people saw us and said, "Look, how sweet!" did they really imagine that we had picked the matching outfits ourselves? I'll admit, the one time I tried to dress differently from Shiva, I felt uneasy as we stood before the mirror. It was as if my fly were undone. It just didn't feel right. We, the twins, were famous not just for dressing alike, but for sprinting around at breakneck speed, but always in step, a four-legged being that knew only one way to get from A to B. When Shiva Marion was forced to walk, it was with arms locked around each other's shoulders, not really a walk, but a trot. Champions of the three-legged race before we knew there was such a thing. Seated, we shared a chair, seeing no sense in occupying 2. We even used the loo together, directing a double jet into the porcelain void. Looking back, you could say we had some responsibility for people dealing with us as a collective. Ask the twins to come inside for dinner. Boys, isn't it time for your bath? Shiva Marion, do you want spaghetti or injera and what tonight? You or your never meant one of us. When we replied to a question, no one cared which of us had spoken. An answer from one was an answer for the twins. Perhaps the adults believed that Shiva, my busy, industrious brother, was naturally parsimonious with his words. If the sound of the anklet which he insisted on wearing counted as speech, then Shiva was a terrible chatterbox, only silent when he muffled the tiny bells under his sock for school. Perhaps the adults believed I never gave Shiva much of a chance to speak, which was true. But no one wanted to tell me to shut up. In any case, in the hullabaloo of our bungalow, where the bridge crowd congregated twice a week, where a 78 RPM spun on the Grundig, and where Ghosh's lumbering tread rattled the dishes as he struggled to learn the rumba and the cha-cha-cha. 2 years went by before the adults fully registered that Shiva had stopped speaking. When we were infants, Shiva was considered the more delicate. It was his skull that Stone attempted to crush before Hema saved us. But then Shiva hit all his developmental milestones on time, lifting his head when I did, and crawling when it was time to crawl. He said Amma and Ghosh on cue, and we both decided to walk when we were a month shy of 1 year of age. Hema and Ghosh were reassured. According to Hema, we forgot how to walk within a few days of taking our first steps, because we had discovered how to run. Shiva spoke as much as he needed to well into his 4th year, but about that time he began to quietly hoard his words. I hasten to say, Shiva laughed or cried at the appropriate times. He often acted as if he were about to say something just when I piped in. He punctuated my words with exclamations from his anklet, and he sang la-la-la lustily with me in the bath. But when it came to actual words, he had no need for them. He read fluently, but refused to do so aloud. He could add and subtract big numbers at a glance, scribbling out the answer while I was still carrying the one over and counting fingers. He was constantly jotting notes to himself or to others, leaving these around like droppings. He drew beautifully, but in the oddest places, like on cardboard cartons or the back of paper bags. What he loved to draw best at that stage was Veronica. We had an issue of Archie Comics in the house. I bought it from Papadakis's bookstore. The 3 frames on page 16 had to do with Veronica and Betty. Shiva could reproduce that page, complete with balloons, lettering, and cross-hatch shading. It was as if he had a photograph stored in his head and could spill it onto paper whenever he wanted. He left nothing out, not even the page number or the stain of the fly that had met its death on the margin of the original. I noticed that he always accentuated the curved line under Veronica's breast, particularly when compared with Betty's. I checked the source, and sure enough, the line was there, but Shiva's was thicker, darker. Sometimes he improvised and departed from the original image, rendering the breasts as pointed missiles about to launch, or else as pendulous balloons that hovered over the kneecaps. Gennett and I covered for Shiva's silence. I did it unconsciously. If I was talkative to excess, it was because I saw this as the necessary output for Shiva Marion. Of course, I had no problem communicating with Shiva. In the early morning, the shake of his anklet, ching-ding, said, "Marion, are you awake?" Dish-ching, was time to get up. Rubbing his skull on mine, said, "Rise and shine, sleepyhead." All one of us had to do was think of an action, and the odds were the other would rise to carry it out. It was Mrs. Geraghty at school who made the discovery about Shiva's having given up speech. The Loomis Town and Country School catered to the merchants, diplomats, military advisers, doctors, teachers, representatives of the Economic Commission for Africa, WHO, UNESCO, Red Cross, UNICEF, and especially the newly formed OAU, the Organization of African Unity. The Emperor had offered the gift of Africa Hall, a stunning building, to the fledgling OAU, a cunning move that would bring the organization's headquarters to Addis Ababa, and already was boosting business for everyone from the bar girls to the Fiat, Peugeot, and Mercedes importers. The OAU kids could have gone to the Lycée Gibramerium, an imposing building that loomed over the steepest part of Churchill Road. But the envoys from the Francophone countries, Mali, Guinea, Cameroon, Ivory Coast, Senegal, Mauritius, and Madagascar, had an eye to the future. And so the cars with the code diplomatique plates carried les enfants past the Lycée to the Loomis town and country. For completeness, I must mention St. Joseph's, where, according to Matron, the Jesuits, those foot soldiers of Christ, believed in God and the rod. But St. Joseph's was boys only, which ruled it out for us because of Gennett. Why not the rough and tumble of the government schools? If we'd gone there, we might have been the only non-native children, and we would have been in a minority of kids with more than one pair of shoes and a home with running water and indoor plumbing. Hema and Ghosh felt their only choice was to send us to Loomis Town and Country, which was run by British expats. Our teachers at LT&C had their A-levels and the odd teaching certificate. It is astonishing how a black crepe robe worn over a coat or a blouse gives a Cockney punter or a Covent Garden flower girl the gravitas of an Oxford don. Accent be damned in Africa, as long as it's foreign and you have the right skin color. Ritual. That was the balm to soothe the parents' disquiet about what they were getting for their money at LT&C. Gymkhana. Track and field day, the school carnival, the Christmas pageant, the school play, Guy Fawkes night, Founders Day, and graduation. We carried so many mimeographed notices home that they made Hema's head spin. We were assigned to Monday House, or Tuesday House, or Wednesday House, each with its colors, teams, and house masters. On track and field day, we competed for the glory of our house and for the Loomis Cup. Every morning in assembly hall, Mr. Loomis led us in assembly prayer, then a reading from the Revised Standard Version, and then we belted out the hymn from the blue hymnal while one teacher or another banged out the chords on the assembly piano. I am convinced that one can buy in Harrods of London a kit that allows an enterprising Englishman to create a British school anywhere in the Third World. It comes with black robes, pre-printed report cards for Michaelmas, Lent, and Easter terms, as well as hymnals, prefect badges, and a syllabus, assembly required. Unfortunately, the LTNC students' pass rates for the General Certificate of Education O levels were terrible when compared with the free government schools. There, the Indian teachers were all degree holders whom the emperor hired from the Christian state of Kerala, the place Sister Mary Joseph Praise hailed from. Ask an Ethiopian abroad if perchance they learned mathematics or physics from a teacher named Curian, Koshi, Thomas, George, Varughese, Ninan, Matthews, Jacob, Judas, Chandi, Eapin, Pathros, or Paulos, and the odds are their eyes would light up. These teachers were brought up in the orthodox ritual which St. Thomas carried to South India. But in their professional roles, the only ritual they cared about was engraving the multiplication and periodic tables, as well as Newton's laws, into the brains of their Ethiopian pupils, who were uniformly smart and who had a great aptitude for arithmetic. My class teacher, Mrs. Geraghty, called Hema and Ghosh at the end of a day when I stayed home from school with a fever. She knew us as the adorable stone twins, those darling, dark-haired, light-eyed boys who dressed alike, who happily sang, ran, drew, jumped, clapped, and chattered to excess in her class. The day I stayed home, Shiva ran, drew, jumped, and clapped, but never uttered a word, and, when called on, would not or could not. Hema went from disbelieving to blaming Mrs. Geraghty. Then she blamed herself. She cancelled the dancing lessons at Juventus Club, just when Ghosh had mastered the foxtrot and could circumnavigate a room. The turntable got its first rest in years. The bridge regulars shifted to Ghosh's old bungalow, which he had been using as an office and clinic for private patients. Hema checked out Kipling, Ruskin, C.S. Lewis, Edgar Allan Poe, R.K. Narayan, and many others from the British Council and the United States Information Service libraries. In the evenings, the two of them took turns reading to us in the belief that great literature would stimulate and eventually produce speech in Shiva. In those pre-television days, it was entertaining, except for C.S. Lewis, whose magical cupboards I didn't buy, and Ruskin, who neither Ghosh nor Hema could understand or read for long. But they persisted, hoping that at the very least Shiva might yell for them to stop, the way I did. They kept on even after we'd fallen asleep, because Hema believed one could prime the subconscious. If they had worried over Shiva's survival after birth, now they worried over lingering effects of the antiquated obstetric instruments that had been applied to his head. There was nothing they would not try to bring about speech. Shiva remained silent. One day, soon after we turned 8, we got home from school to find Hema had a blackboard installed in the dining room. She stood there, chalk at the ready, copies of Bickham's Penmanship Made Easy, Young Clerk's Assistant, at each of our places, and a maniacal gleam in her eyes. On top of each book was a shiny new Pelican pen, the Pelicano, every school kid's dream, along with cartridges, such a novelty. A time would come when I would be glad to be known as a surgeon with good handwriting. My notes in the chart perhaps gave some intimation of similar skills with a knife, though I will say it is not a rule, and the converse isn't true. Chicken scratch scribbles aren't a sign of poor technique in the theatre. One day, I would grudgingly thank Hema for making us copy in the round and ornate styles, "Knowledge shall be promoted by frequent exercise. Art polishes and improves nature. Fortune is a fair but fickle mistress. Yesterday misspent can't be recalled. Vanity makes beauty contemptible. Wisdom is more valuable than riches." Shiva was already fingering his Pelicano. Genet said nothing. Her position in these matters was delicate. I stood firm. I didn't trust Hema's motivation. Guilt leads to righteous action, but rarely is it the right action. Besides, I had planned a special parade of my dinky toys in a weaving path I had carved out on a low embankment next to the house. Her timing was terrible.
"Why can't we go out and play? I don't want to do this," I said.
Hema's mouth tightened. She seemed to be considering not what I said, but my person, my obstinacy. Subconsciously, at least, she blamed me for Shiva. She saw me and even Gennet as having camouflaged his silence in a blanket of chatter.
"Speak for yourself, Marian," she said. "I did. Why can't we... I go play?"
Shiva already had his cartridge loaded.
"Why? I'll tell you why, because your school is nothing but play. I have to see to your real studies. Now sit down, Marian."
Gennet quietly took her seat.
"No,"
I said.
"This isn't fair. Besides, it won't help Shiva."
"Marian, before I twist your ear..."
"He won't speak till he is ready,"
I shouted. With that, I dashed out. I flew around one corner of the house, gathering speed on the turn. At the second corner, I ran straight into Zimui's broad chest. My first thought was Hema had sent the military to get me.
"Cousin, where is the war?"
Zimui said, smiling, peeling me free. His olive uniform was as crisp as ever, the belt, holster, and boots all brown and gleaming. As a reflex, he stomped his right foot and snapped a salute with enough vigor for his fingers to sail off. Sergeant Zimui was the driver to a man who was now full colonel in the Imperial Bodyguard, Colonel Mebratu. Ghosh had saved his life in surgery years before. Colonel Mebratu was once under suspicion, but now he was in the Emperor's favor. He was both senior commander of the Imperial Bodyguard and liaison to the military attachés from Britain, India, Belgium, and America, all of whom had a presence in Ethiopia. The colonel's job involved frequent diplomatic receptions and parties, not to mention the regular bridge nights at our place. Poor Zimui could only begin his long walk home to his wife and children when his boss's head was on the pillow and the staff car parked in the shed. The colonel had assigned Zimui a motorcycle to make it easier for him to get back and forth. Since Zimui, who lived near Missing, didn't want to ruin his tires on the crude stone and shingle track that led to his shack, he got Ghosh's permission to park the bike under our carport. There, his precious machine was sheltered from the elements and from vandals.
"Just the person I was hoping to see," Zimui said. "What's the matter, my little master?"
"Nothing," I said, suddenly embarrassed. My troubles seemed minor when talking to a soldier who'd just done his tour with the UN peacekeeping forces in the civil war in the Congo. "How come you're picking up your motorcycle so late?" I asked.
"The boss was at a party till 4 in the morning. When I got him home, the sun was coming up. He told me I could come back in the evening. Listen, come, sit down. I want you to read me this letter again."
He parked himself on the edge of the front porch, took the blue and red aerogram from his front pocket, and handed it to me. He took off his pith helmet to extract a half-smoked cigarette tucked carefully under one of the straps on the outside. The pith topi, in the manner of white explorers of old, was unique to the Imperial Bodyguard, recognizable at a distance.
"Zimui," I said, "can I read it later? Hema is after me. I talked back to her. She'll cut off my tongue if she catches me."
"Oh, that's serious. Of course we can do it later," Zimui said, springing up.
He put the letter away, but I could sense his disappointment.
"Do you think Darwin got my letter by now?"
"I am sure his letter is coming, any day."
He saluted me and went on to the back of the house. Darwin was a Canadian soldier who'd been wounded in Katanga.
I'd read his letter to Zemui so often I knew it by heart. He said it was cold and snowing in Toronto. At times he was discouraged, and he didn't know if he could ever get used to a wooden leg.
Are there women in Ethiopia entrusted in a one-leg white man with a scarred face?
He did not have much, but if his pal Zemui ever needed anything, he, Darwin, would do it, because he'd never forget how Zemui saved his life. I'd written back in English for Zemui, translating as best I could. I wondered how the two had conversed in the Congo. Zemui showed me a pinwheel gold pendant which he wore around his neck, a St. Bridget's cross. The wounded Darwin had pressed it on Zemui when they parted on the battlefield. The sight of Rosina peering back at me as Zemui walked toward her made me start running again. I felt a vacuum when my brother should have been running next to me. My mother's grave, with its halo of fresh-cut apothecary blooms and its inscription of "Safe in Arms of Jesus," held no fascination for me. But in the autoclave room next to Operating Theatre 3, I sensed her presence, a scent, a feel so linked to mine. That was where my feet took me. It wasn't the smartest choice as a place to hide. I never understood Shiva's reluctance to visit this room. Perhaps he saw it as a betrayal of Hema, who had watched over his every breath, who had linked herself by a cord to his anklet. Coming here was one of the few things I did alone. Seated in my mother's chair, the scent of cuticura and the cardigan, I spoke to her, or perhaps I spoke to myself. I complained about injustice at home. I confessed my worst fear, that Hema and Ghosh might one day disappear, just as Stone and Sister were no longer in our lives. It was one reason I loitered around Missing's front gate. Who was to say Thomas Stone might not come back? My fantasy was that on a sunny morning when the air was so crisp that you could hear it crackle, Gibru would open Missing's gates, and instead of the stampede of patience, Thomas Stone would be standing there. The fact that I had no idea what he looked like or what my mother looked like was inconsequential to this fantasy. His eyes would fall on me. After a few seconds, he would smile with pride. I needed to believe that. I returned to our bungalow to face the music. There was music, all right, and the sight of Hema leading Genet and Shiva in dance. All three of them wore dance anklets, not Shiva's usual kind, but big leather thongs with four concentric rings of brass bells. They had moved the dining table against the wall. Indian classical music with a snappy tabla beat marked time. Hema had tucked her sari so that one loop ran between her legs, creating what looked like pantaloons. She taught Shiva and Genet a complex series of steps and poses in the time I'd been out. Arms in, arms out, arms together, pointing, dipping, drawing a bow, firing an imaginary arrow. The eyes looking this way and that, the feet sliding, a cymbal clash of anklets every time their heels thumped the floor. It hurt me to see this. Shiva, Genet, and I had entered the world almost in unison. Genet was a half-step behind and a womb across from us, but she'd caught up. As toddlers, we had freely traded milk bottles and pacifiers, much to Hema's dismay. Shiva's propensity to jump into buckets, puddles, or ditches full of water terrified the adults, who feared he'd drown. To keep him from deeper water, Matron purchased a jolly baby wading pool. Here, the three of us splashed naked and posed for pictures that would embarrass us one day. Our first circus, our first matinee, our first dead body. We arrived at these milestones together. In our treehouse, we picked at scabs until we found red, and then we took a blood oath that we three musketeers would stand together and admit no other. Now, we'd arrived at another first, a separation. I stood outside, looking in. Hema beckoned me to join. She was no longer angry. Her forehead glinted with perspiration, strands of hair stuck to her cheeks. If she planned to punish me, perhaps she saw in my expression that it had already happened. Genet, with an anklet, looked more feminine, more like a girl than the tomboy I knew. I never gave much thought to that sort of thing. In the games we played, she was like any boy. Now, as she danced, she was a step off, struggling. Despite that, she was graceful, extraordinarily so, as if the anklet had unlocked this quality in her. Even when she missed her cue or bungled the turn, suddenly she was, and I couldn't help but notice, all girl. My twin had no miscues. He'd learned the dance in a flash, I could see. He had a way of holding his chin high, as if fearful that otherwise the curls he balanced on his head would slide off, and it made him seem taller, more upright than me. That mannerism of his was exaggerated in the dance. When Shiva was excited, his irises turned from brown to blue, and they were that way now as his heels hit the floor in unison with Hema's, and he matched her every dip and flourish. It was as if his anklet moved him, and that in copying the sound of Hema's anklets, the requisite movement of his body came about. I studied this lean, supple creature as if seeing him for the first time. My brother, who could draw anything from memory, who could juggle huge numbers in his head with ease, had now found a new vehicle for locomotion and a new language for his will to express itself, separate from me. I didn't want to join in. I was certain that I would look clumsy. I felt envious, almost as if I were a handicapped child, unable rather than unwilling to participate. Traitor, I said to Shiva under my breath. But he heard me. There was nothing wrong with his ears, and he'd have known what I said, even if I had said it only to myself. My twin brother, my skull mate, this little dancing god, skated away, averting his eyes. Chapter 19. Giving Dogs Their Due. The week before Shiva gave up his anklet, we were all driving into town when a motorcycle, siren wailing, went tearing by, waving us off the street.
All right, all right, Ghosh said, pulling to the side. His Imperial Majesty Haile Selassie I, Lion of Judah, needs the road.
We piled out onto Menelik II Avenue. Down the hill was Africa Hall, which looked like a watercolor box standing on its side. Its pastel panels were meant to mimic the colorful hems of the traditional shama. Outside the new headquarters for the Organization for African Unity, the flag of every country on the continent had its spot. The building in its short existence had already been graced by the likes of Nasser, Nkrumah, Obote, and Tubman. The Emperor's Jubilee Palace was on the other side of the avenue. I could see the mounted imperial bodyguard sentries, one on each side of the palace gate. The emperor's residence rose behind the lavish gardens like a pale hallucination of Buckingham Palace. At night, the floodlit building glowed ivory. Since it was that time of year, one of the pines in the compound was strung with lights and became a giant Christmas tree. Pedestrians, gharis, cars, everything came to a stop. A barefoot man with milky eyes took off his tattered hat to reveal a ring of curly grey hairs. Three women in the black cloth of mourning, umbrellas over their heads, also waited next to us. They were sweating from the effort of walking uphill. One of these ladies sat on the curb. She eased off her plastic shoe. Two young men stood back from the curb, looking displeased at having to interrupt their walk. The seated woman said,
"Maybe His Highness will give us a lift. Tell him we can't afford the bus. My feet are killing me."
The old man glared, his lips moving as if working up the spittle to chastise her for such blasphemy. Now, a green Volkswagen with a siren and loudspeaker on top sped by. I never thought a Volkswagen could go that fast.
"I bet you His Majesty is in the new Lincoln," I said to Ghosh.
"The odds are against you."
It was 1963, the year Kennedy was assassinated. According to a schoolmate whose father was a member of parliament, the Lincoln was President Kennedy's used car, but not the one in which he'd been shot. This one was covered and was spectacular, not for its curves, but for its impossible length. A joke had circulated in town that for the emperor to get from the old palace on top of the hill, where he conducted his official business, down to the Jubilee Palace, all he had to do was climb into the back seat and come out of the front. Of the 26 cars at His Majesty's disposal, 20 were Rolls-Royces. One was a Christmas present from the Queen of England. I tried to imagine what else was under a monarch's Christmas tree. A Land Rover passed by, Imperial bodyguard, not police. Moving slowly, its tailgate open, men with machine guns across their thighs looking out. We heard a rumble that sounded like war drums. A phalanx of 8 motorcycles emerged out of the ether, 2 abreast, the air shimmering around the engine's fins. The sun glinted off chrome headlights and crash bars. Despite their black uniforms, white helmets, and gloves, the riders reminded me of the wide-eyed, monkey-maned warriors who came out of the hills on horseback on the anniversary of Mussolini's fall, looking mean and hungry to kill again. The ground shook as the Ducatis slid past, huge reserves of horsepower ready to be unleashed with a turn of the wrist. His Majesty's green Rolls-Royce was polished to a mirror-like finish. On a built-up seat, His Majesty looked out of windows specially constructed for monarchs to view and be viewed. In the wake of the motorcycles, his car was all but silent, save for a faint wheeze from the valves. Ghosh muttered, "For the price of that, we could feed every child in the empire for a month." The old man next to us was on his knees, and then as the Rolls reached us, he kissed the asphalt. I saw the emperor clear as day, his little dog Lulu on his lap. The emperor looked directly at us, smiling as we bowed. He brought the palms of his hands together. Then he was past.
"Did you see that?" Hema said excited. "Did you see the namaste?"
"In honor of you," Ghosh said. "He knows who you are."
"Don't be silly. It was the sari. Still, how sweet."
"Is that all it takes to sway you? One namaste?"
"Stop it, Ghosh. I don't get involved in politics. I like the old man."
The Rolls turned toward the palace gate. The motorcyclists and the Land Rover pulled up just beyond the gate. The two guards on horseback, resplendent in their green trousers, white jackets, and white pith helmets, presented arms. A lone policeman held back the usual cluster of petitioners who waited on one side of the gate. An old woman waving her paper must have caught the emperor's eye. The Rolls stopped. I could see the little chihuahua, its paws on the window and its head snapping back and forth. Lulu was barking. The old woman, bowing, thrust her paper to the window with both hands. She seemed to be speaking. The emperor was evidently listening. The old woman became more animated, gesturing with her hands, her body rocking, and now we could hear her clearly. The car moved on, but the old lady wasn't done. She tried to run with the Rolls, fingers on the window. When she couldn't keep up, she yelled,
"Leba! Leba! Thief! Thief!"
She looked around for a stone. Finding none, took off her shoe and bounced it off the trunk before anyone could react. I saw only the rise of the policeman's club, and then she was slumped on the ground like a sack. The palace gate swung shut. The motorcycle riders ran forward and began clubbing anyone near the gate, ignoring their shrieks. The old woman, motionless, nevertheless got a vicious kick to her ribs. The mounted sentries stared straight ahead, their mounts disciplined and still, only the horse's skin twitching. We stood, stunned. The two young men behind us snickered and walked quickly away. The woman next to us, her hands on her head, said,
"How could they do that to a grandmother?"
The old man, hat in hand, said nothing, but I could see he was shaken. As we drove away, I saw the motorcycle riders had turned on the policeman, giving him a good thrashing. His mistake was not clubbing the old woman down before she opened her mouth and embarrassed them all. These many years later, even though I have witnessed so much violence, that image remains vivid. The unexpected clubbing of the old woman, seconds after the emperor had greeted us so warmly, felt like a betrayal, and with it came the shock of knowing Hema and Ghosh were powerless to help. In my mind, that bug-eyed chihuahua was a party to the cruelty. She was the only creature permitted to walk before His Majesty. She ate and slept better than most of his subjects. From that day forth, I had a new perception of the Emperor and of Lulu, and I definitely didn't like that overweened dog. If Lulu was the canine empress of Ethiopia, our Cthulhu and the two nameless dogs were the peasantry. A Persian dentist who'd worked briefly at Missing christened her Cthulhu. To name a dog in Ethiopia is to save it. Missing's two nameless dogs had mangy coats that were so mud and tar-stained that one could not be sure of the original color. During the long rains, when all the other dogs sought shelter, these two stayed out rather than risk a boot to the head. It was quite possible that they were, in fact, a succession of nameless dogs who happened to visit in twos. Sister Mary Joseph Prays fed Cthulhu when the Persian dentist disappeared. After her death, Almaz took over. Cthulhu's eyes were expressive dark pearls. They hinted at a playfulness, a mischievousness, that life's disappointments hadn't quite snuffed out. Dogs aren't supposed to have eyebrows, I know, but I swear she had folds that could move independently. They conveyed apprehension, amusement, and even a befuddled look that reminded me of Stan of Laurel and Hardy fame. We saw their films at Cinema Adwa. There was no question of Cthulhu coming into our house. Cows were sacred. Dogs were not. We didn't know Cthulhu was pregnant until the day after New Year's. We hadn't seen her for 2 days, and then, just before we left for school, we found her behind the woodpile in a crawl space. Our flashlight revealed her utter exhaustion. She could barely lift her head. The fur balls wriggling at her belly explained everything. We ran to Hema and Ghosh, and then to Matron to tell them the exciting news. We thought up names. In retrospect, the adults' lack of excitement should have warned us. Our taxi dropped us at Missing's front gate after school. We had just crested the hill when we saw it, though at first we had no idea what we were seeing. The pups were in a large plastic bag whose mouth was tied with a cord to the exhaust pipe of a taxi. We found out later that the driver had seen Gibru making off with the litter, and he'd proposed a less messy means of getting rid of the pups than drowning them. Gibru, always in awe of machinery, was too easily convinced. Under our eyes, the cabbie fired his engine, the bag ballooned out, and in a few seconds the car stalled. Cthulhu, who that morning could hardly walk, tore around the wheels of the car, nipping at the smoke-filled bag. Inside it, her puppies, their snouts overblown when they pressed against the plastic, tumbled over one another, looking for an exit. Cthulhu's expression was beyond grief. She was crazed and desperate. Patients and passers-by found it entertaining. A small crowd had gathered. I was numb, disbelieving. Was this some necessary ritual in the raising of puppies which I didn't know about? I took my cues from the adults standing around. That was a mistake. But inside, I felt just like Cthulhu. Shiva took his cues from no one. He ran to the car and tried to untie the plastic bag from the exhaust pipe, burning his palms in the process. Then he was on his knees, ripping at the thick bag. Gibru pulled him away, kicking and fighting. Only when Shiva saw that the puppies were quite still, a hillock of fur, only then did he stop. I glanced at Genet and was shocked by her deadpan expression. It said she was well aware of the undercurrents of the world we lived in, and had known well before us. Nothing surprised her. How Cthulhu could forgive us and live on at missing, I never understood. She knew nothing of matrons' quotas and edicts for missing dogs. Just as we didn't know that several times in the past, Gibru, under orders, had plucked Cthulhu's newborns from her teats and drowned them. Shiva had scraped his knees and blistered his hands. Hema, Ghosh, and Matron rushed to meet us in casualty. Ghosh put Silverdine on Shiva's burns and dressed his knees. The grown-ups had nothing to say about the pups.
"Why did you let Gibru do that?" I said.
Ghosh didn't look up from the dressings. He was incapable of lying to us, but in this case he'd withheld knowledge of what would happen.
"Don't blame Gibru," Matron said. "They were my instructions. I'm sorry. We just can't have packs of dogs roaming around missing."
This didn't sound like an apology.
"Cthulhu will forget," Hema said soothingly. "Animals don't have that kind of memory, my loves."
"Will you forget if someone kills me or Marion?"
The adults looked at me, but I hadn't spoken. Moreover, I was a good 8 feet away from where Shiva was getting bandaged. His irises had gone from brown to a steely blue, his pupils down to pinpoints, his chin thrust higher than ever, exposing his neck so that he was sighting down his nose at a world populated by people for whom he seemed to have the greatest disdain. "Will you forget if someone kills me or Marion?" Those words were formed in the voice box, shaped by the lips and tongue of my heretofore silent brother. For his first spoken words in years, he'd crafted a sentence none of us would forget. The adults looked at Shiva, and then at me. I shook my head and pointed to Shiva. Finally, Hema whispered,
"Shiva, what did you say?"
"Will you forget about us tomorrow if someone kills us today?"
Hema reached for Shiva, wanting to hug him, tears of joy in her eyes. But Shiva drew back from her, drew back from all of them, as if they were murderers. He bent down, rolled down his sock, and snapped off the anklet, placing it on the table. That anklet had never come off except to be repaired, enlarged, and 3 or 4 times replaced by a new one. It was as if he'd cut off a finger and laid it on the table.
"Shiva," Matron said at last, "if we let Cthulhu have her litters, we'd have about 60 dogs around missing by now."
"What happened to the other puppies?"
Shiva asked, before I could. Matron mumbled something about Gebru having disposed of them humanely, and that the car exhaust was ill-advised and not sanctioned, and Gebru should have done it well before we came back from school. I was in step with him now. Shiva touched my shoulder and whispered in my ear.
What did he say?
Emma asked.
He said, when you all are so cruel, why should he speak? He says he doesn't think Sister Mary Joseph Praise or Thomas Stone would have done something like this. Maybe if they were here, this would never have happened.
Emma sighed, as if she'd been waiting for one of us to bring their names up in just this way.
Darling,
she said, in a voice like gravel, you have no idea what they might do. Shiva walked out. Ghosh and Matron had the stunned expression of people who had seen a ghost. Now they were the ones who were mute. How, I wondered, could these adults who cared so much whether my brother spoke or not, who cared for the poor, the sick, the motherless, who were as bothered as we were by the cruelty to the old woman outside the palace, be so indifferent to the cruelty we had witnessed? I asked Matron later if she thought that the death of her pups left scars on Cthulhu's insides. Matron said she didn't know, but she did know that missing couldn't afford to breed dogs, and three was the limit. And no, she didn't think there was a separate dog heaven, and frankly she did not know God's opinion on what was the right number of dogs for missing, but he had given her some discretion on this matter, and that was not something she wanted to debate with me. After the killings, I saw in Cthulhu's eyes her disappointment in us as a race. She sought out places where she could curl up and not run into humans. We left food out for her, and if she ate, it was not when we were around. For weeks, there was only one person for whom she would attempt to wag her tail, and that was Shiva. When Shiva learned to dance Bharatanatyam and became Hema's Sishya, and she was already talking about his Arangetram, his debut, I first began to see him as separate from me. Now that he would talk and could express himself, Shiva Marion didn't always move or speak as one. In earlier years, our differences had complemented each other. But in the days after the death of the pups, I felt our identities slowly separating. My brother, my identical twin, was tuned to the distress of animals. As for the affairs of humans, for now at least, he was to leave that to me. Chapter 20. Blind Man's Buff. Mr. Loomis, headmaster of Loomis Town and Country, saw to it that our long holidays coincided with the long rains. That way, he could be in England in July and August, relaxing, spending our school fees while we were stuck in Addis Ababa. Old hands in Addis referred to the monsoon months as winter, which hopelessly confused new arrivals for whom July could only be summer. It rained so much that it even rained in my dreams. I awoke happy that there was no school, but that incessant murmur on the tin roof immediately dampened the euphoria. This was the winter of my 11th year, and when I went to bed at night, I prayed that the sky should open up on Mr. Loomis wherever he was, be it Brighton or Bournemouth. I hoped that a personal thundercloud trailed him every minute of that day. Shiva was unaffected by cold, fog, mist or wetness, while I became morose and pessimistic. Outside our window there was now a brown lake dotted with atolls of red mud. I lost faith that a lawn and flower bed could ever reappear out of that. On Wednesdays, Hema took us to the British Council and USIS libraries, where we returned books, checked out a new pile, loaded them in the car, and then she dropped us off at the Empire Theatre or Cinema Adwa for the matinee. We were free to read whatever we wanted,
but Hema required of us a half-page journal entry to record new words we learned and the number of pages we had read. We were also to copy out a memorable idea or sentence to share at dinner. I resented this winter curriculum, but it did bring Captain Horatio Hornblower sailing into my life. Matron, whose ability to read my soul I did not yet fully appreciate, asked me to borrow a ship of the line for her. I opened it out of curiosity and found I had sailed into a world more damp and wretched than my own, and strangely, I was happy to be there. Thanks to C.S. Forrester, I was on a creaking ship on the other side of the world and in the head of Horatio Hornblower, a man who was like Ghosh and Hema, heroic in his professional role. But he was also like me, unhappy and lonely. Of course, I wasn't really unhappy or lonely, but in the monsoon season it seemed necessary to think of myself that way. The unfairness of the Admiralty in London, the irony of Hornblower's seasickness, the tragedy of his returning from a long voyage to find his children mortally ill with smallpox. I had my equivalents, trivial as they were, for all these perils. After hours of reading, I itched to be outdoors. I know Gennett did, too. Shiva sketched and scribbled. Hamer's calligraphy exercises catalyzed an unstoppable ink flow in Shiva's pen, but his medium was still paper bags, napkins, and end pages of books. He loved to sketch Zumui's BMW and had done so in every season. Veronica, if he drew her, now straddled a motorcycle. On a Friday, after Ghosh and Hema left for work, the rain came down harder and there was now thunder and hail. The noise on the roof was deafening. I peeked out of the kitchen door and was met by the scent of sopping hide and the sight of three donkeys sheltering under the roof overhang along with their overseer. If the wood the donkeys delivered was anywhere as wet as they were, it did not bode well for our stove. The animals stood still, resigned to their fate, half asleep, their skin twitching involuntarily. When I went back to the living room, Gennett yelled above the racket,
"Let's play blind man's buff."
"Sissy game," I said, "stupid girl's game." But she was already hunting for a blindfold. I never understood why blind man's buff was so popular at school, particularly in Gennett's class. I'd seen the mob dancing just out of reach of it, pushing or buffing the blind man till he or she captured a tormentor. The blind man had to name the captive or set the person free. We modified the game for indoors, no buffing of the blind man. Instead, you hid by standing silent, though with the din on the roof you could be whistling and it wouldn't matter. You could hide anywhere but the kitchen and not under or behind a barrier. Time was the object of the game. How fast could the blind man find the other two? That morning, Gennett went first. It took her 15 minutes to find Shiva and 10 more to get me. You would think after 25 minutes of standing there, I would be bored. I wasn't. I was intrigued. It took discipline to stand stock still. I felt like the Invisible Man, one of my favorite comic book characters. The Invisible Man stood as the world moved around him, as his arch-enemy tried to find him. Blindfolded, wearing white tights, her arms reaching in front of her, putting one foot out then the other, Gennett looked helpless, as if she were walking the plank on a pirate ship. She had the upright carriage and the balance of one who could do cartwheels with an arm tucked to her side, and who could walk on her hands with more grace than Ghosh on 2 feet. Barrettes made of yellow and silver beads were snug around her hair, which was parted in the middle and pulled up into 2 stalks. Gennett wasn't vain about her dress, but when it came to headbands, combs, pins, and banana clamps, she was most particular. Of course, this trait might have been more Hema's or Rosina's or Almaz's doing. They were forever brushing her hair or braiding it into ponytails or rows.
Hema sometimes put coal inside Genet's lower lid. That black line highlighted her eyes, made them catch fire and flash like mirrors. Girls matured faster than boys, so they said, and I believed it because Genet acted older than 10. She distrusted the world and was more argumentative and always ready for